So I will start with Darren's slides by saying a lot of the material, as is the way with academics, is borrowed liberally from other people's sources. So Darren was very good to list the people here from whom he made significant borrowings or whatever, as well as a lot of the links. So if you want to follow up on any of these things, generally the name of the person from whom it was borrowed is on the slide itself, and you can then reference that to go and look up the link. But again, any email questions later would be very welcome by Darren, who feels terrible that he's not here to be able to talk to you. So I just wanted to recap very, very briefly the kind of topics that I stumbled through yesterday. Essentially, what we did was we broke down the astroparticle, the incoming signals, into a few different areas. Yesterday, we covered primarily cosmic rays. So the case where you have some particle coming in, a proton or maybe a light nucleus or something coming in from outside of the atmosphere, interacting in the atmosphere, producing, you know, the signal which you're able to detect. So what we said was this was essentially akin to having a great accelerator. This is basically a beam dump experiment, a great accelerator somewhere out in the galaxy or somewhere farther away, in which you're accelerating particles up to very high energies. Those particles leave the accelerator, they go on, they can go on to interact with a medium, which we've got in a target on this slide. And then you're creating a beam basically that's coming down, coming in towards Earth, interacting on Earth, and we'll be able to see. And so what we're doing with a lot of these kind of projects is we're exploiting the kind of natural accelerators that are out there. And as we looked at several times yesterday, we're actually doing better by doing this. We're reaching energies that we have not been able to accelerate particles to on Earth, may not ever be able to accelerate particles to on Earth. In fact, there's a number of different restrictions that can apply for doing that. But what we talked about last time was we talked primarily about things like protons being accelerated, going through and finding this. So when we looked at the spectrum, kind of the energy spectrum of these signals, we said that we could break this down into a few different regions by energy. And the way that we broke it down was by looking at the messenger that could be used in order to find these things out. So when we talked yesterday, we talked mostly about the higher energy. We talked about direct photons coming in. You're able to get to very high energies. And then, you know, we talked about the showers in the atmosphere and being able to detect the particles on the ground. And this is an excellent way to probe up into extremely high energy particles way out here in the, you know, 10 to the 20 EV and potentially beyond. So that was yesterday. Now we're going to focus a little bit different. We're going to change the energy range, and we're going to look at lower energy and things that we're going to do. And instead of using kind of, you know, protons and cosmic rays to do that, we're going to look at gammas. So we're going to look at higher energy things and how we can kind of resolve those higher energy things. So one of the interesting kind of ways to look at this, I think, is to look at kind of the energy spectrum. So yesterday, when we talked about cosmic rays, I had presented this kind of energy spectrum when we said, you know, there's this very nice power law relationship that goes on as you go up in energy. It's very smooth. There's a few kinks which have been identified, the knee and the ankle. And we talked a little bit about the rarity of the events that happen, particularly at higher energies. So what we can do is look across kind of the broad electromagnetic spectrum and say, you know, can we look at much larger energy range for doing these things? And of course we can. So when you're down, if you're looking at either, you know, equivalently low energy or kind of the longer wavelength things, you're looking at like radio and maybe the cosmic microwave background as you work your way across. Then you can get into the little bit of IR, but mostly into the optical and the UV. And there you're able to use, you know, optical telescopes, the Hubble, the James Webb, something like that, that are going on. As you keep going up in energy, you get into the X-ray background, which is XRB, that's labeled here. But once you get above that, you're essentially into the territory of gamma rays. You're looking at gamma rays of kind of GEV type scale and above that. And one of the interesting things that can be done, and is kind of presented well in this plot, is if you overlay the cosmic ray spectrum, which has been done, obviously I was just pointing at it, you see that that really there's kind of this continuation that goes on here. There's similarities both in terms of the kind of the flux and of the shape of the spectrum. So it really is hinting at, or you know, indicating some kind of a connection in the production mechanisms for all of these things, that they're likely being produced at the kind of higher energies in similar ways. So that's really an exciting way. And gamma rays kind of give you a window to study this kind of direct thing that's coming from the source. There are challenges to using gamma rays, obviously. One of them is the distance scale. So at gamma rays, as you start to increase their energy, they start to actually interact with things like the cosmic bright ray background, and then they're lost, essentially. We can't use them anymore as a good messenger for getting from our high energy accelerator down to the Earth. So we're really going to be looking kind of today in like the TEV, PEV scale sources, and primarily in our own kind of galaxy and the local neighborhood. So there's a lot of information contained in this particular plot, a lot of things going on in this plot, but I think it's kind of important to be able to kind of have present it that way. Okay, so yesterday I had a lot of fun talking about the kind of historical way that cosmic ray physics was discovered. We can also do that somewhat for the same thing for looking for the gamma rays coming in. So back in the late 40s, people had made this conjecture that some of the night sky, the kind of the light in the night sky, was due to Cherenkov radiation from particles coming in from the outside. So I'm assuming people know Cherenkov radiation, that you know, you have a particle which has an energy such that its speed is above the speed of light in the medium in which it travels, and therefore it starts to radiate and you get this really nice cone. I'll have some pictures of it later, but anyway, there was this conjecture that some of the night sky luminescence was from that. And so then this really to me is a wonder of the ability of some physicists to scrape things together. So this was the first detector that was used to try and find things. So you may first of all notice that this is just a trash can which has been painted black on the inside. And on the inside, there is the reflector mirror from a searchlight. So a searchlight was taken apart. The reflector mirror was placed so that it's looking up. You can see here. And then a PMT is placed in the middle of it to take any signals that are incident on that searchlight mirror, bounce them up to the PMT and detect them. You can see the kind of sketch here where you've got this mirror, you've got this PMT. It's placed at, you know, the focal length here. It's really, I don't know, I was really taken with this when I was doing this research. So this was run, and it was usually, your PMTs are sensitive to single photons, which is good. And they're usually in the blue to UV range, which is convenient. This is, you know, maybe one of the ways that Cherenkov light can come up. So this was run and observed about one pulse per minute. So that really said that Cherenkov radiation is probably due to the night sky intensity. So this was kind of a proof of concept, but a proof of concept that was really well executed, in my opinion. And then later on, a slightly better, a slightly more advanced, technologically advanced version was taken up to Pic du Midi. And there was a lot more studies done that were basically trying to characterize the polarization of the light that came out and the energy spectrum of the pulses themselves. And it was found that both of those matched the predictions that were given at the time for things coming in from the outside. So, I'm really taken with this. And in fact, in doing this research, I got a little bit caught up, because it turns out this wasn't it. There was also an array of Geiger-Müller tubes, which were put around this kind of ad hoc setup, and looking to see coincidences, which were seen at a rate of about 50% of the time they saw coincidences. So this was just a really well-executed, well-thought-out experiment that I was really happy to have had the chance to encounter. So yeah, I thought this was really cool. But this is kind of the start of things. So this is when people are saying, We think there's something coming in from outside the atmosphere. If there is something, is it actually creating that light in the atmosphere? And is that light partially responsible for the night sky luminescence, the night sky limit, which it is, in fact. So I thought this was really brilliant. But enough ranting about this. So really, what we're looking at is something that's similar to what we talked about yesterday. So what we have when we're looking for something coming in from the outside, you have a very high energy gamma. So that's your primary in this case. It's coming in and it's interacting with particles in our atmosphere. And then you're getting a strictly electromagnetic shower. So you remember that yesterday we talked about these showers. We had the hadronic shower. We had some muons that were going on in there. This is strictly an electromagnetic shower. So all of these charged particles, they're starting to emit this Cherenkov radiation, which is in the kind of blue to UV range. And they're starting to emit it in a cone, which is directionally along the axis of the particle, of the particle direction itself. So this is what we're looking at here with our shower coming in. And if we project down, you can see that then there is this cone of light that is produced and this cone of light that is then visible and detectable on the Earth's surface. So theoretically, this sets us up to be able to say, okay, we can set something up on the surface of the Earth and we can see the light that was generated by these high energy particles that were interacting in the atmosphere. So that's already fairly impressive. So I think the way that's been suggested to think about this, it's kind of the same way, you know, the way it looks when you're viewing a meteor shower, I guess. The physics is very different. But what you're seeing really is the interaction of something that's going on in the atmosphere, depositing significant energy. And you're also in the case that you're able to view this in the visible spectrum. So in some ways, it's kind of akin to meteors. But it does set us up so that you're able to detect it. So what you would like to do is design kind of a camera that you could image the Cherenkov radiation. And this is kind of what you would see. So in this case, your camera is a very large area. The telescope is just this large mirror system, essentially. And the reason for that you want to make it large is, of course, you want to see lots of the sky because these events are rare and you're trying to capture all these photons produced. But these mirrors will come down. If you could have all of these camera, you know, each one of these little mirrors be a camera, you could think of reconstructing this. But in fact, the easier way to do it is to have mirrors that reflect the light up, very similar to the kind of basic equipment that we saw earlier, where you had the searchlight mirror that reflects the light back up into PMT and concentrates it. You can do the same thing here, where you can have the light that's captured by these mirrors reflected up, and then you can capture it with very sensitive photodetectors like PMTs. And this gives you actually an image of the shower that occurs. Well, it gives you an image of the light that's generated from the shower itself. So that image can contain a lot of information that you can then try to get out of it. For example, you could think about the amount of charge that's deposited, so the amount of light that actually comes in, the amount of charge that's gathered by your photodetectors, that is proportional to the energy, right? You're able to say that this, the more light I get, the more charge that's gathered by my photodetectors, the more energetic was the particle that came in, and the more energy has been kind of expended into the shower. And then you can think the orientation of the picture can actually give you the direction of the shower itself. So if you can kind of think, there'll be some pictures coming up in a second, which will make this hopefully a little bit more clear. But you can think of, if you're looking at the intersection of that cone with the ground, if this comes in at an angle, you're actually able to see that it has a different shape, and you're able to reconstruct the shape and get some directional information from what's going on. It can also tell you a little bit what the primary actually was. So the original, you can tell you whether it's a gamma ray, which was kind of the more rare event, or a hadronic shower. The more common event, or the hadronic shower, which is one of the more more common for the hadronic shower than the gamma ray. I got those backwards in the end, but yes, hadronic shower is much more common than the kind of light that you're generating from the gamma rays. So we can go on and see there's a few kind of simulations here of what things would look like. So these The next couple of slides show how the detected image changes based on the orientation of the shower and the location of the shower relative to your telescope. If you manage to get something coming in and be incident on your telescope, which would be here, you obtain this kind of really nice, roughly circular image. So the center being the highest intensity, and then the shower falls off, obviously, as you move away from the center itself, and you get this nice pattern in your detector here. If instead it's not directly aligned with your telescope, if your telescope is off to the side and you have something coming down that's not aligned, you end up getting just capturing the edge of the shower that's falling into your field of view. And so you'll get this kind of elongated object. So this gives you a lot of direction information, especially if you have multiple telescopes, which we'll get to a little bit later. If you have more than one, you're able to do some really nice directional reconstruction of, you know, using the images from multiple telescopes to trace backwards and try to find out where this came from. And of course, the directional information itself can be incredibly useful for reconstructing and for knowing where things are. Sorry, you cannot see or hear me. Is anybody there? Huh. Okay. So it must be a technical problem on the side of perimeter, I guess. Ah, okay. I wonder how long I was talking to just a few people. Okay, so yeah, it looks like the people online can see and hear me. But maybe we lost perimeter at some point.
We're back.
We're back.
Oh, excellent. It's good to have you back.
So, We lost the last 5 minutes.
Maybe not 5 minutes.
Oh. Four.
Yeah. Oh, three.
Okay, there's some debate over the actual amount of time. Did we get to the creation of showers?
Yeah. 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 Make sure I have a question. Can you hear us?
Hello? Yeah, I can hear you.
So this gamma ray particle is for sure absorbed by the atmosphere. Can it be like travel through atmosphere and directly comes to the
I think if your question is the gamma ray, the original gamma ray that comes in, what we're really expecting to happen is that gamma ray kind of creates this whole electromagnetic shower, much the way we saw yesterday. You're creating, you know, the kind of photons that then can create more gamma rays or more electrons, and you're doing that kind of dance as you're going down and dumping energy into all of the creation of particles. So
I'm asking how much chance of that original gamma ray travel through atmosphere without any interaction and directly detected gamma ray, the original gamma ray.
Oh, you want to detect the original gamma ray itself? That's very, very unlikely for surface-based detectors. Now, you can talk about sending up satellites to go kind of outside of the majority of the atmosphere, and then you can maybe start thinking about detecting the original gamma rays. But once we're on the surface of the Earth, we're really looking for the products of the gamma rays. It's very similar to a lot of detectors in which you're doing some sense an indirect detection. You have the original particle coming in, creating a bunch of other particles, and you're seeing the results of that, the other particles. You're not seeing the original one itself. Is that kind of in line with your question?
And another one, why do you say it's just electromagnetic showers? Can it like collide with a nuclei and create some other particle?
The interactions that we're looking at here are really just electromagnetic. You really have, you know, photons coming in, they can do a number of things. You know, they can interact with high energy electrons. They can, you know, they can do pair production. They can do that kind of thing, but they're limited in what they can do. So we're talking strictly electromagnetic particles that are coming through this way.
Thank you.
No, no problem at all. So is it reasonable to start here? Is that roughly where?
That's the slide you're on, yeah.
Oh, okay, perfect. So I was mumbling a lot of in this slide about if you wanted to actually detect the light, how would you do it? And so you would design some kind of camera system. You'd put the camera on the ground, you'd point it up, and you'd look at the light coming down and look where it intersected. And then you'd want that camera segmented so that you had lots of different pixels. You could tell what was going on in each pixel. But really, the way to do it, or the way that has been chosen to do it, is kind of akin to what was done in the original, I don't want to call it the trash can detector, but the original detector, in which you have a mirror that reflects that light back up into a sensitive photodetector. And so you're able to control the light entering that photodetector, you reflect what's coming in, and in that way you're able to do this and still maintain this kind of segmented version. And it gives you a lot of energy, a lot of information, right? From kind of the shape and the intensity, you're able to gather a lot of things. The total amount of light collected, which will translate through your photodetectors into the total charge, can give you the amount of energy in the shower itself. You know, the shape of it can give you a lot of the direction and potentially even tell you the what happened in the beginning, whether it was kind of the hadronic shower, which is a lot more common, or whether it really is the gamma ray that's come in and done all of this. So when I was talking about shape, you know, you can think, here's kind of some simulations of what things would look like. So you have a particle coming in that's actually incident on your detector itself. You've gotten, I guess, lucky. And it's the kind of core of the shower, the direction of the shower is incident on your detector. And in that case, you get this kind of nice circular image. You get a bunch of charge deposited at the center. It falls off rapidly as you go towards away from the center. And you get this nice image, kind of what's shown here. If the direction of your shower is not in line with your detector, we have our detector here, the direction of the shower would miss the detector, and you would essentially end up getting the edge of the shower that's in the field of view. So that resolves in your detector as an elongated object. So this gives you directional information, certainly. And the way it can give you better directional information is if you have multiple detectors. If you have multiple of these kind of shapes that you're able to then reconstruct and go backwards, you can get very good directional information about what the original shower looked like. And that's kind of what's shown here, is if you have a single telescope, you're able to see something here. If you have multiple telescopes, you can then start to do this triangulation exercise where you're able to track back and try to recreate the primary direction. So this is essentially feeding directly into the angular resolution of your detector, which is one of the things that becomes very important. It also collects a lot more information if you have multiple detectors about the charge deposition that you're observing, which gives you the energy resolution and the overall shape feel, the shape of the event. And that can let you do a lot of background rejection. So once you have these things, you're able to say, where did the kind of shower, where was the direction of the primary reconstructed from the shower? What was the energy that was deposited? What was the energy of the primary that came in? And is it something that we are actually interested in? Then you're talking about really doing astronomy, right? Like really doing precise measurements, which is what I guess this whole thing is all about. So when I was talking about this, I said that the shape itself can allow you to do, the shape features can allow you to do some background rejection. So what I meant by that is kind of what's shown in this slide. So we know that we have, for example, a much higher rate of hadronic showers. You can see the numbers here. Your hadronic showers in the scale of, you know, maybe 100 hertz in some area that you're looking at, whereas, you know, you're getting at the utmost hertz rate for the kind of electromagnetic gamma showers. But the shapes and the way that they reconstruct and the way that they reconstruct on the ground are very different. So these two simulations, this one shows the how the gamma rate this kind of evolves over time as it's going down. So you have your, you know, primary coming in, it interacts, and you have all of these interactions, you know, you're producing, you know, you're interacting with the electrons, you're producing more photons, those are producing more electrons, they're doing all these interactions, but they're staying fairly close. And when you get this kind of nice smooth distribution as it's going down, very much centered on the original direction of the primary up here. So that would be what your kind of gamma, your electromagnetic shower looks like. If you're looking at a hadronic shower, it looks a little bit different. You have your primary coming in, but then of course you're producing all these, you know, charged pions, you're producing, you know, you're maybe blasting protons and neutrons out, you're doing all sorts of things that we talked about yesterday. So you end up with this very different shape. And I don't just mean the extent that's shown here. You can see that what happens is you end up with kind of clumps of interactions. So you'll get some particles, maybe you're energetic enough to do like strange production or something, you're able to generate things that are that will interact and just kind of create their own little showers going on here. So you can see that there are different regions in which this is very clumpy and very not the same as the kind of gamma shower. So this is another way, another kind of handle or another way that we can get information about the showers, which is can lend itself to the background discrimination. So this is something that's also very useful when looking at these things. So at TeV energy, so at the energies that you know we've been talking about, the first thing that was seen was the Crab Nebula. We talked about the Crab last time, and we talked a lot about supernova remnants last time. So the Crab is the supernova remnant. It's got a pulsar, which is just a rotating neutron star at the center, and it's kind of powering this whole thing. So it was first measured at the Whipple Observatory in Arizona, which is this 10-meter Air Cherenkov telescope. So here you can see a lot of the structures that I was talking about before. You can see the mirrors. So all of these mirrors that are there to reflect the light that's gathered, they reflect it all going at the center and coming back in here into the camera system at the focal point. So essentially, this is the way that this was done. And this, the Crab Nebula being the first one, it really has kind of become, as we said last time, kind of the standard calibration device for TeV gamma rays. So it's like nature has kind of provided this calibration source that's out there. And when you know, you bring on your new gamma telescope and you're really impressed with how shiny and new it is, and you want to look at something and impress people with the way that you can image it, you really tend to start with the Crab. And so that's something that's you know, kind of evolved and that after this one being the first one. So this is the kind of the paper that came out of it. So it was the first discovery we can discuss. This I don't really want to, but somebody could discuss what a discovery is. This was more than a 5 sigma measurement of the Crab using the Whipple telescope. So you can see here, if you're looking at the angles from the Crab, then you can see this significant increase in the direction of the Crab and going back down to background when you're pointed away from the Crab. So this is something that is, you know, pretty impressive and was done, you know, way back in the 80s, you know, that kind of time. But it was it's a really impressive measurement and kind of proved that this is all possible and that this can actually be a useful tool for measurement. So we can talk then a little bit about the different energy ranges and the different experimental kind of techniques that are used to measure these energy ranges. This goes a little bit into the question that was asked earlier about can you see the primaries, and this is what you're looking at if you're in kind of the satellite range. I think this, you know, was answered on the chat maybe. The satellite range where we're looking at, you launch a satellite above the, or at least above most of the atmosphere, and you can see the GEV particles coming in. These are particles you would not be able to detect, you know, were they to shower onto the ground, you just, you know, you wouldn't be able to collect enough from them. So you can get up and see a lot of these particles up here. The next kind of energy step, you're doing the Air Cherenkov version. So this is where we're talking about the measurements that I was just doing. You're looking at your particle comes in the roughly kind of TeV energies. It does the electromagnetic showers. All those particles are generating the Cherenkov light, and they're detected on at the ground here. And there's a few different telescopes that do that. MAGIC, Veritas, Hess are the ones that are listed here. So those are good ones. As you keep going up, you can actually start to detect the particle shower itself if you get into kind of the PeV range. And there you're generally doing it with Cherenkov, but you're not doing it with the air Cherenkov anymore. There you're getting all of the electromagnetic shower to come down, interact in your detector, in some of the things going on in your detector, like you're generating your light within your detector itself from those that electromagnetic shower. So you're looking at water Cherenkov, and that's, you know, Hawk and Lasso and a few other things. And conveniently, there are some pictures of these detectors lined up with their energy. So there's a picture of the Fermi. So one of the interesting things as well is the kind of extent, the actual physical extent of these detectors, the size of the detectors. So the Fermi is on the order of kind of meters, that kind of thing. Whereas when you get into looking at these arrays, of course, are distributed. They're large arrays gathering all sorts of information here. And then when you're getting up into bigger energies, you're starting to talk about really large extended arrays. So in fact, that's one of the areas here. The effective area of the satellites, the Fermi scale, you know, is a meter squared, whereas it's, you know, 10 to the 5 meter squared for both the kind of air or atmosphere Cherenkov telescopes and Hawk, which is an example of the PeV scale, where you're looking for the water Cherenkov and the interactions of the ground. So there are some other things that are interesting that differentiate these events. For example, the field of view. You get pretty good field of view with Fermilat. Of course, Fermilat is going around and sweeping out a lot of area as well. And Hawk, you have a relatively large fraction of the sky that you can see. The air Cherenkov, of course, you're limited for the amount of the sky that you can actually see with the particles that are coming in. So you get a couple of degrees. The energy resolution can be very different. So if you're if you're gathering up in the, you know, up on the satellites, you can do pretty well. 10% energy resolution is pretty good. It's the same roughly in the air Cherenkov or atmosphere Cherenkov, but if you're talking about the water Cherenkov, there's a lot more uncertainty in the energy collection that you're doing. And of course, PeV gamma rays are, you know, creating this very large shower. It's very difficult to collect a lot of that. So you're kind of limited in how well you can do. The angular resolution is one that we talked about a little bit. This, of course, it can be incredibly important if you're trying to trace back to look from where these things came. The sky is really big, and there's a lot of things in it. So you want to be able to do as well as you can in the angular resolution. And so the air Cherenkov does very well with the angular resolution. And the kind of water Cherenkov, the ground-based, can do pretty well as well, but the Fermilat has a little bit more of a range. So if you're thinking, you know, okay, you're getting most of your highlights from the air Cherenkov telescopes, like most of the kind of best of all worlds coming from those, yes, except for kind of the duty cycle, which is the last one. If you have a water Cherenkov detector, of course, it can run all the time. If you have your satellite up there, it can run, you know, as long as it's operational and in the sky, it can run. But air Cherenkov telescopes can be limited. Any kind of bright objects, like, for example, the moon is a fairly big thing. So there, it's very difficult to observe on, you know, full moon nights if there's a lot of ambient light going on. If there's a lot of, for example, stormy weather happening, that kind of thing, air Cherenkov telescopes can be eliminated for all those. And it likely goes without saying you can only operate at night, probably, but you can only operate at night anyway. So in a year, you're getting roughly 1400 hours for those. So that's a lot of time. You're able to get a lot of data, and the data that you get is very good, but you just have these limitations, which it's very difficult to overcome. So last time we talked a lot about the kind of way that supernova remnants accelerated things. I don't want to go back too far at that, but we can look back, for example, at our favorite supernova remnants. We've seen that the energy that the release is related to the shock waves, and you can get a lot of energy coming out, 10 to the 39 ergs per second, which is pretty impressive. And that's, this is in terms of energy of the crab. So it's about 10 times the energy of the crab. So it, just as a reminder, basically what we have is we have this particle doing this walk across the shock wave. And every time it crosses the shock wave, it goes between up and downstream and gains energy at each stage until it eventually escapes. And so you've provided the mechanism for it to accelerate by moving back and forth across this wave and then escape on its way out. So that particle gets accelerated significantly and escapes. That particle eventually collides with something, often something quite nearby, like interstellar dust or something to that, something like that, that happens to be around. And you get this high energy shower that will produce the pions that are coming out, same way that we talked about it last time. But then we can get the high energy pionots, the neutral pions, to decay. They give you, as long as there's something, you know, there, and they give you the high energy gamma rays. And those gamma rays then ultimately escape and they can go out and they can be detected. So that's what's being shown here. You have your pions going out, you have your gammas coming from the pionot decay, and they're going out here. So the gamma ray production, so we know that the gamma ray spectrum follows the proton spectrum. And we know that the scale is roughly 10 to 1, smeared over about a decade. So the gammas appear about 10 times lower in energy. So if we were to look at this plot where we have this kind of smear, where this is from one TeV protons, you can see that TeV is actually the scale above. So the proton has you know, come out with a TeV of energy, and it's produced these gammas that are peaked a roughly a factor of 10 lower in energy. So this is important. So it is really, if you're saying that you observe, for example, 100 TeV gamma rays in from a source, you must have at least a PeV protons. So, I mean, that's, you know, you're able to say this kind of 10 to 1 region. And we know that the cosmic ray spectrum we talked about before follows this power law. And so it's kind of not surprising that the gamma one does here as well. And it's nearly the same spectral index. And so this is all very good. And you have, for example, here you have this kind of E to the E squared normalized flux as a function of energy. You can see that it rises here, it rises up, peaks, and then experiences this sharp cutoff. So this is just showing the energy production from two different primaries. You have the 100 TeV proton and the TeV protons. And so this is just saying, you know, we can tell a lot about the energy of the primary from the energy of the proton, for the energy of the gammas that we see that were generated from it. So these are, this is, I guess, a reference which you can look up, but the dominant processes that we considered are energy dependent, that's true, but are the ones that we see normally in gamma interactions. So you have Bremsstrahlung, which is the virtual photon off of an electric field. You have synchrotrons, you're interacting with the magnetic field. You have inverse Compton, where, you know, your photon is scattered to higher energies with an interaction with a high energy electron. And so this is the way that we're actually expecting all of these things to interact. So I think that this is just here to provide a reference in case you're really interested in that. But again, if you want to know more, you can email Darren. He had intended this to be, maybe he had intended to talk a little bit more about that, but I think I'm running a little bit late, so I'll skip a little bit of that. So we're looking now at a higher energy regime. And so we're looking at two different ways that these are created, the synchrotron radiation and the inverse Compton radiation. And what we're doing is here, the interesting part to take from this is that the underlying spectrum is the same, but you can have all of these different varied cutoff energies. So the underlying spectrum, is these two lines being in parallel, of course, the index of two, but they have this varied cutoff energy. And here the electron spectrum is flat as noted. Another thing to note that's sort of interesting is this kind of interaction, this pileup at the end, where we had been getting this nice regular pattern. There's actually the lines start to come together. And what you see is in the Compton scattering, you get the Klein-Nishina regime. where the high energy of the particles impacts the differential cross-section for the electron-photon interaction. So you're talking about the electron changing as you go up. So this causes the compression of lines here in interactions with the CMB. It means essentially that the inverse Compton is less efficient at losing energy with high energy electrons. So you become less efficient at losing energy here with these high energy electrons. And so you have this kind of compression of the curves as they go up. So if you look, for example, at a well-studied object, then you can see data from both the synchrotron production and the kind of model fit and that of the gamma rays from the Pinot decay. So we're seeing here the synchrotron production where there is some data that's going on here with the model shown, and also the Pinot decay here where there is data shown from Hess and Kangaroo that's saying, you know, that it seems to follow the model fairly well. And the interesting part is what's shown here, that when we see actually the peak in the kind of the peak flux from the synchrotron and the peak flux from the inverse Compton is separated roughly by the magnetic field squared. And you can have a look here if you're interested in looking this up, but this is where you're getting your particles from a known source. The same object, you can start to look at how well the data actually maps when you're looking at what the different accelerations are occurring. Is it hadronic, which is kind of this size here, or is it leptonic, which is going here? And you can see both those models are overlaid here, and you're looking at the different kind of data that's shown along with the deviation from the model shown along here. So there's interesting stuff going on here in the high energy gamma ray region. And you can see, for example, in the split here from the electrons that it does not follow well anymore. There's this split as you go down in the photon energy. There's a split as you go up in photon energy, but that's, you know, maybe something that can be resolved, which if we can get some more data. You can see, for example, that the data here is there isn't much. Of course, we're starting to talk about high energies and rare events, but the error bars are becoming large. And so it becomes much more difficult to say what's going on. And it would be helpful to have a little more data further on in this style. So the search really that has been going on so far has been to try to find PEV sources of acceleration within the galaxy. And so gamma rays have a huge advantage on this distance scale. We know that we can see the gamma rays. We know that at these energies within the galaxy, they can actually make it to the Earth to do these interactions so that we can see what's going on. And there's a spectral change in the cosmic ray spectrum just kind of above these energies. And it's thought to be that's the transition from cosmic rays from the galaxy to those from extragalactic sources. So one of the main, you know, favorite targets for looking at these things has been the center of the Milky Way. We know that Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. It's got this supermassive black hole at the center. And we know from what I kind of went through last time that these regions have the potential to be really good particle accelerators. I talked a little bit last time without a whole lot of justification about there being a lot of free energy. We talked a little bit about the supermassive black holes being able to accelerate things through the kind of inductor engine when you have plasmas spinning and they provide all of this energy. So this we know that there can be a lot of accelerators coming from these regions. So this image that's being shown here shows over an 8-year period, you've got TeV gamma ray emission at the galactic center. So this is by Hess, as it's shown here, over 8 years, which made up about 220 hours of on-source observations. So you can see kind of the resolution that has been achieved here. There's a lot that's going on. There's a lot of things in this image, and we can kind of have a look through it. So first of all, there's the correlation with molecular clouds. So we have, you know, there's all sorts of things going on here where there's, you know, target masses that are happening in these molecular clouds that can be used for this kind of thing. Where there's the gamma ray luminosity in some of the regions. We know that the density can go with the luminosity over mass. And there's also, we can start to talk about the radial distribution and how that can sort of be used to define what was going on. So if it's homogeneous, it's probably just you know, diffusive propagation that's going on here. If you kind of get this relationship where it's over the radius squared, then it's probably wind-driven propagation. If you get it just over the radius, it's kind of diffusive propagation, a little bit like the homogeneous, but you're getting continuous injection. And so we know the central accelerator located within, you know, 10 parsecs or so and injected cosmic rays for, you know, a long time. And so you can see in the kind of plot in the bottom here where we have this emission, where we have the model and we have the kind of emission here. So there's the best fit, and then there's the best fit if you do kind of energy cuts. And you can see that as the energy cuts go on, you actually get this change. And this is allowing us, by looking at those, the kind of regions of energy, to do a lot of determination, a lot of information gathering about what's been going on. So this is pretty interesting stuff and led to this being a what's been called a pevatron. Doesn't roll off the tongue, at least for me, but you know, it's been, you know, you're getting something that's accelerating to BEV energies. So this is a big deal, and what's been going on in terms of those energies and in terms of finding sources for this kind of thing. So I'm going to move on now to doing kind of the detection, apparently, of very high energy gamma rays. So I talked about those at the beginning, where in this case, what we talked about originally was the shower that's coming down. The EM shower is doing air Cherenkov and gathering all this light. But what if you want to go higher energy and you want that shower to continue down to the ground and collect some of the particles from that shower itself? That is somewhere where you can actually do something that looks like this. This is the Hawk detector, the Hawk Observatory, which stands for the High Altitude Water Cherenkov. So each one of these, we'll see a blow up in a second, is essentially just a big water tank. So they're just 300 of these water tanks packed really close together. Each one is acting as a detector on itself. There has been a high energy extension with the outriggers, which was put in a few years ago. Now, 2018, I guess it says right on the slide. More than a few, I guess. But anyway, this high energy extension that went out to try and gather some more of the range. Obviously, if you have your shower that's coming down and you're looking to, if it's a high energy shower, so it is has a, you know, a rather large extent, and you're looking to gather as many of those particles as you can because you want to understand the energy resolution or the energy of the original particle that you had, you need the energy resolution is going to be tied to the amount that you actually collect. So you want to have these kind of large extended arrays. And one way to do that is to take your core array and then extend it out with some of these, what they call outriggers. So this is a detector that doesn't obviously have to worry about the moon and things like that. You have a very high uptime for it operational. It has a very wide field of view. You're able to see a lot of the sky all the time. And it really gives you a nice way of detecting high energy particles that are coming down. So as I promised, this is the look of what's happening inside these tank chambers. Really, you're talking about just kind of a tank of water. This tank of water that you've put out in this array, you put it inside something dark and you want to keep the water, you know, clean so that you can do this. But then your particle is going to come in and generate Cherenkov light inside the tank itself, much like maybe you're going to hear about snow or you have heard about that kind of thing. The same thing, we're looking for the particle to generate the Cherenkov light. And then you have the photosensors at the bottom. And in this case, the photosensors are these, you know, PMTs, photomultiplier tubes that people have probably seen, where you're able to take the light, change it into an electrical signal. I probably don't want to go through how all of that works, but it basically takes the light and changes it into an electrical signal that you can read. And so Hawk has been in operation for some time, obviously. And they're able to kind of start to make maps of what things look like. And so this is the Hawk sky map, looking at the kind of significance of sources in their test statistic. This one, I always have trouble with trying to understand how things look. The center of the galaxy is not where I expect it to be. So we were kind enough to actually have the kind of galactic, you know, the plane here, way more in a normal location. Whereas here, you know, the galactic plane is got this weird curved shape once you put it into the kind of more, or at least version I'm more comfortable with, the galactic plane lies across the center here. and you can see what Hawk has been able to do. So this is pretty impressive, you know, in that that Hawk has been able to gather all of this stuff. I did say earlier, I just want to flash back on this quickly. I talked a lot about the primary coming in and having this kind of nice smooth electromagnetic shower, or this big clumpy hadronic shower, and the hadronic shower is what's going on more often. So you're having to cut out all of this in order to see the nice smooth electromagnetic shower. Hawk has done some work here in being able to reject these backgrounds. So this is about, you know, as you kind of look out the extent. So as you start from the center, so you have the reconstructed center, and then you look out along the range. What does the signal look like? What is it that you're actually gathering? So what's shown is the light level, so the amount of charge that's generated in each PMT, and you're able to look out and see, okay, this is probably a hadron. You know, look at this. There's these kind of big clumps that are happening. There's these spurs that are coming off kind of the central region. It's this clumpy way. But in the gamma, in a nice gamma shower, you have this really nice smooth distribution that goes down. So because you're most worried about this kind of reconstruction and figuring out cutting down your backgrounds by removing these, you know, these hadrons, if you're just looking for the high energy gamma rays, you're really wanting to cut most of these out, stick with just these nice smooth ones. And this gives Hawk a really kind of efficient and nice way to do this distinction. There's a reference here if you want more details about it, but it's pretty neat that that's that they have that ability. So the other thing that that of course can happen is you can use the same instrument, and as you get, you know, as you get experience with running it, as you have more and more time to do your analysis, you can actually improve your analysis techniques. So what's shown in top and bottom is the same. Obviously, it's all from Hawk. There's a little bit, there's a little bit more data in the bottom than in the top, but it's really the improved reconstruction techniques and analysis techniques that give you this better resolution that are coming in here. So you can see the same features, they're just defined better in the bottom. And this is something that's great, and Hawk has been able to do and be able to go back, analyze a little bit more data, but with much better techniques and get this improved resolution. So what we really want to do is find sources of PEV gamma rays. That's the core, right? And so what we know is that we, you know, we haven't seen this from the supernova remnants. From what we can tell, they don't seem to accelerate into that range. But what about star-forming regions? So this apparently is one of the most recent results from Hawk. It's another galactic Pevatron object. So what you're seeing is this cocoon that's in the Cygnus region. It's the largest star-forming region in the solar neighborhood, and includes not only some of the brightest, but also the, you know, the brightest and the most massive stars known. So what you're seeing in these two plots is just a masking of the binary. So there's a binary here. It probably says that in here, yeah, two massive stars orbiting tightly. So you're producing X-rays in here, but you want to mask those out to get the kind of second, the plot on the right here. And there are observations here of 100 TeV gamma rays coming from this kind of this region around here. And if you remember the factor that we said, 100 TeV gamma rays will translate into PeV protons that are coming out. So this is some new kind of object. Everything likely comes from these hadronic interactions originally in here, but it's one of the really early examples of an object emitting, you know, gammas on the order of 100 TeV. So where we're looking at, you know, PeV primaries. So this is really kind of new and really neat physics that's been going on. So this is the spectrum, which was presented there, the error band and the bars, the uncertainties on the energy, which is in the statistics here. So we have data from a few different, of course, Fermilat is the satellite, which is providing more on the lower energy, kind of the GeV scale. And then when that kind of goes, Hawk takes over at the, you know, tens of TeV and up. But what's important here is, well, then maybe there's maybe there's two things that are important here. One of them is that there's kind of this nice continuation in the flux across the energies and experiments, which is encouraging that things seem to be going well, seem to be going properly, or that, you know, we're understanding things and measuring them properly. I mean, one of the biggest things, of course, is trying to understand your detector. And so seeing the kind of continuity across multiple detectors gives you a lot more confidence that the analysis that you've done has been, you know, potentially correct and you're understanding your detector properly. The other maybe important thing is that Hawk does not seem to show the cutoff at higher energies. These are not limits. These are actual, this is data. There was data collected up here. So you're talking about, you know, hundreds of TeV. So there doesn't appear to be the cutoff there. So that's kind of interesting. The other thing that might be interesting is trying to distinguish if we're able to say, you know, this is something that's happening on kind of from a burst, there was a recent burst that happened, or is this a continuous injection? And so I talked a little bit earlier about the kind of continuous. I'm sure that it was not entirely comprehensible, but what I was trying to get across was that there's a difference between what would happen in a kind of continuous injection of energy versus kind of the burst energy. So if we're looking at models, you can see the two different models here, the continuous injection modeled in the dashed line, the kind of burst in the solid line. And so you can see that, okay, you know, the data that we have, such as it is from both Fermi and from Hawk here, it says that we're following the general pattern, but the uncertainties, particularly at these higher energies, mean that we have no way of distinguishing between these two at the current time. So this really speaks to the need for statistics, really. I mean, it's really the kind of, we're looking to improve, or the Hawk people are looking to improve the statistics available. And if you can improve the statistics sufficiently, that was really hard to say, then you could actually start to distinguish between these two. At very high energies that we're talking about here, of course, events are rare. So you're going to have something that is going to collect a lot of events, a lot of very rare events, but you could start to be able to tell things apart. And that would be really interesting. So maybe what we want to do is have a new type of observatory, which is not just, well, we'll get to what it's made up of, but is trying to contain the best of all worlds in, excuse me, in one location. So this is the LASO, the Large High Altitude Air Shower Observatory. You can see that's here. This is really the state of the art in terms of collecting, maybe not even very high energy, but now ultra high energy gamma rays. So you're looking at to target that kind of higher one. So the location is here, which is in Tibet, I guess, I think. Yeah, I believe. So it's in the mountains here. It's obviously at this higher energies or higher altitudes, which we're going to, you know, it's going to be an advantage. And this is what it's made up of. So this is really just the extent of this detector is fairly amazing. So there are these kind of meter squared electron detectors. There will be a slide in a little bit that'll have a little bit more information about which of these are. But there's these meter squared ones that are spaced out by 15 meters, and there's 5,000 of them spread across this site. So there you're detecting kind of the electrons that come in. Then there's muon detectors, which are bigger. You know, they have a bigger footprint. They're spaced out more widely. You can see them here. So we're, you know, they're all kind of spaced out around there. And then there's a whole lot of the water Cherenkov detectors that we talked about before. There's 3,000 of them, and they're fairly big, 25 square meters. And then there's these kind of wide field Cherenkov telescopes that you can see here. And then so the water Cherenkov detectors in the center, the wide field Cherenkov telescopes on arrays on the side. So what is being done here is trying to combine a number of different technologies to have access to a lot of information about the showers from the same location. So if you think about where these are doing, the TEVs are being provided, the TEV kind of range is in these water Cherenkov. We just talked about those, like the ones that Hawk are doing. And then if you're getting into really high energy, you're starting to get into this kind of kilometer squared array. But the individual, if you're looking at the nuclei in the spectra, you can view this wide field Cherenkov. And then it's going to benefit all of these different regions, which is not so much, you know, the point of doing this, but it really is, there's great physics to be done in a number of different areas from this. So this is the way that I thought was actually kind of easier to see what's going on. So we have these, what we talked about earlier, we have the surface water Cherenkov detectors that are, those are the ones that we had that are like Hawk, where you have the, you're looking for the particle to come in, interact in the water, produce the light, it's detected. And then you have underground water Cherenkov tanks. So there you're looking for particles going to actually penetrate. You're looking for your muons and things like that that will penetrate down into your underground water Cherenkov tanks. And then you have surface detectors. So you're looking at scintillator detectors that are just there in order to catch the particles that are going to cause the scintillation. And at the same time, you have this wide field air Cherenkov telescopes. So as your shower comes down, you have kind of all of the things that we've talked about going on, and you can use that all on the same thing. So the part of coming down is having this electromagnetic shower. You're able to see the Cherenkov light that's going from your array of Cherenkov telescopes. As the shower kind of comes down and hits the ground, you'll be able to detect it both in the scintillator detectors and in the kind of water Cherenkov detector. And then if you want to catch some of the other things that are going on, you know, you can actually go down a little bit underground and use the water Cherenkov that's buried. So this combination of information from these events is really phenomenal. And it's really kind of, this is the state, as I said earlier, the state of the art that's going on with the detectors. So here's an example of an event. So this is an observation of, as it says, a 1.4 PeV photon from the direction of Cygnus. So it's got some probability of this chance, and it's at this publication. But what I think is really, what you should really draw from this, first of all, you're detecting this 1.4 PeV, which is incredible. But then also just the extent of the signal, the extent of the shower and the extent of the event itself. This is the, you know, you can see the scale here, 500 meters. So this thing is hundreds of meters across in each direction where you're actually getting this signal that's coming in. And the combination of all of these signals is giving you the information to be able to reconstruct what's going on and reconstruct where, you know, where it came from, the energy, all of the things that we talked about that make astronomy, actual astronomy using these things possible. So this is something that, I mean, it's really pretty fantastic that's been able to, that the information that comes out of here and the way it's been done. And so you can say you want to image the Crab Nebula, your kind of standard candle. And what you can do is you can actually look at it in the different type of detectors. So in the water Cherenkov detector array, you're able to see, yeah, that's absolutely there. So this is in the kind of the 1 to 12 TeV energy. You're able to point back to it, very accuracy. It's got this significance, which, you know, okay, it's definitely there that you're looking for. If you go up higher in energy, you can then go into the kilometer squared array and look at higher energies and say, yeah, so we were able to say that in the kind of 25 to 100 TeV, your resolution is still pretty impressive. It's still pretty close to your point spread function. This is just saying like what your resolution essentially is. So you're looking at what's coming out here. And then if you go into the kind of more greater than 100 TeV, so up into the kind of PeV region, you're able to do even better and see that these things are all coming from here. So you're actually able to see the PeV gamma rays observed coming from the crab, which is an amazing feat. And kind of the one of the things that you're seeing is this is coming from, you know, this is the kind of combination of a whole lot of different experiments, obviously. But then LASSO is able to contribute to a lot of this over the whole region on its own. So in coming from the crab, you can see that, you know, there's all of the data here that's coming from the water Cherenkov, and then you kind of turn that turns off and the kind of the large array turns on. You're able to go up to quite high energies. You're talking in PeV energies here that you're able to detect this whole thing. And the kind of coincidence and the complementarity with the other detectors, which have been detecting data along this, is striking and is notable that you're able to do this kind of thing. So this was, you know, originally people, you know, scientists couldn't really tell how high the energy, how high in energy the spectrum from the crab went. And this is very high. This says that maybe this, at least the crab is a PEV source, and maybe supernova remnants could be a PEV source. And maybe this helps explain some of the kind of spectra that we saw when we talked about this earlier. So there's all of these great benefits. It agrees with other experiments. I kind of rambled about that for a little bit, but it's self-checking in the kind of overlay between the two. But you're really able to say that this is a pevatron. So you're getting these things that are just fantastic and are, you know, you're able to accelerate it at these kind of energy, which is amazing. So there were now 12 galactic PEV sources. You're now kind of getting more recent in kind of figuring things out, observed at greater than 7 sigma. So we can be pretty confident in that these are actually PEV sources. And this is really kind of a landmark for the field, that we as, you know, people are able to detect all of these sources, which is just absolutely incredible. So if you have a look at them in the kind of spectrum, you can see the crab is over here. There's the crab. But then you can see all of the different sources that are identified by LASO, kind of marked along here. Along, this is just a blow up of this region going towards the galactic center. Here it is, you know, in kind of the 100 TeV to PeV sky map, you're able to see these things. But what's really, I think, impressive is that Hawk has previously looked at this region. This is an area which Hawk can see. And you can see the kind of lining up and agreement of all of these things between Hawk and LASO for doing this. So it gives really a new window in the extreme energy scale. So Hawk was not able to give with the same significance, obviously, not able to conclude that these were PEV sources or not. They were able to say that these are high energy sources that are coming out, potentially PEV sources, but LASO has been able to say, yes, these are definitely PEV sources. So this is a really neat, first of all, working together between the two kind of generations of experiments, but also the way that these things line up, I think is very cool. And so with the statistics that are now available, you actually are able to start slicing up your data in different ways. So for example, in energy, you can start to see different features of the sources that emerge and dominate. You can see these, what's happening here is this has been divided into different energy regions. So at the kind of 10 to 25 TeV and then up to 63 TeV, 63 to 158 and 158 to 400, you can see that there's actually different things that are kind of emerging. So, and different areas that are accelerating things to these kind of energies. So what this kind of indicates, and maybe it's clear, is that there are different mechanisms accelerating at different energy ranges. And this is something that you can only kind of make this conclusion, or you can only make this inference, I guess, if you have the statistics available that you can start to slice your data set up. So this is really coming from this one source, and you're looking at this one source, and you have so much information from that source that you can start to bin it and look in the different bins. And so this is also, you know, really due to the newer telescopes and the statistics of the newer telescopes that are available, that you're able to get this kind of binning of information. So I think we can go into the near-ish future of the kind of high energy astrophysical gamma rays. We'll probably get through most of it in the time that I have left, or I could speed up slightly. So if you're looking at high energy gamma rays, really you're looking at imaging atmospheric Cherenkov detectors. You get, what you really want are more statistics, so more events. And so what you need to do that is a larger collection area that's going to provide you more photons, better spectra. You're going to get these images, you're going to get all these better sources, but you also want better information that's coming from these things. So if you can get better measurements of the cascade, you can get better measurements, track that back to the primaries. If you can kind of do what's being a little bit indicated here, if you have a number of different telescopes that are, you know, a large number of different telescopes, you're able to combine that information to track backwards to get better angular resolution. And this also gives you some idea of being able to reject backgrounds using some of the methods that we talked about earlier. Using this, you can start to look at all of the things, you know, all of the evolution of these things with time, see if they fit this kind of nice smooth gamma regime or this clumpy hadronic shower kind of area. And that's letting you cut down your most prominent background your most prominent background once you're observing for these things, which is, you know, trying to cut out all of the hadron stuff. So this says we really, to do all of this, we need more telescopes. So the one that was chosen to focus on was the Cherenkov Telescope Array, the CTA. So it's this really big international project. And what is being done is there's a different scales of telescopes being combined at a few different sites. And using that, you can kind of do the same thing that LASSO is able to do and combine the energy across different ranges to actually, you know, kind of optimize your areas in all of those ranges. So you might have low threshold things, you know, like at 10 GeV, but you have medium, and then you have high, and the high requiring obviously the big, you know, square kilometer, that kind of thing. So there are different sites in, you know, for CTA, the CTA North in La Palma, which I guess is where that dot is, and the CTA South in Chile. The headquarters and the Science Data Management Center, I guess, are kind of also important, but really not to the same extent. So this is the North site, the La Palma site, where you can see that there are the different scales of things. There's the large size telescopes in the red. There's the kind of dark blue, which is the medium size telescopes. And then you have a few other instruments spread around, which you're able to do, including the LIDAR for calibration, which I didn't talk about, or Darren didn't put anything in about the calibration, but I had heard something about it before, and it was pretty impressive the way that they can do that using the calibration devices. But anyway, that's not listed here, so we won't go into it because I'm not nearly an expert there, even less so than in this. So in terms of the southern site, there's the site of Chile, which is spread out into this same thing where you're mixing your kind of medium and small sized, and then you have a core of the large ones. So you're looking at using your core to be able to find these, you know, find these events, and you have an extended array around to do the collection. And this all falls into what we had talked about earlier a little bit, where you want to collect, you know, you want a kind of a dense instrumentation in order to get a nice view back of the angular resolution to try to create and be able to reconstruct backwards. But you want an extended, you know, in detector in order to get the energy resolution. These showers can be very large at high energies, so you want to be able to collect as much as you can. So those are the two kind of things that are fighting here for figuring it out. The science drivers, this is probably important. If you're building a detector, you want to know why you're doing it. So obviously, the primary one, maybe. So how and where are these particles accelerated? That's what we've been talking about through most of this. Where are these accelerators that are generating these incredibly high energies and being able to shoot particles down, shoot stuff down towards us? How do they propagate? How do they actually, you know, get here? And what is their impact on the environment? I'm not sure quite understand that one, but it's part of the acceleration theme. I'm hoping that's the environment of the accelerator, not the environment of the Earth. And then if you want to start being able to use this, so if you're looking at using the sources, the events that you're getting, you can now start to figure out a lot of it, where they're coming from. So can we see things? Can we understand what's happening in neutron stars and black holes? Can we understand more about jets and, you know, all of this kind of thing, and looking at the spaces in the sky? And then you can get into a little bit of the physics frontiers. Everybody wants to get in on what is the nature of dark matter and how is it spread around, and maybe that's something that can happen. And then there's kind of other questions that, you know, are interesting and are on here. So for the CTA, this is just showing where the currently observed sources are, and those will be visible with the CTA. So the CTA visibility is kind of shown along here. The black dots are the first Fermi catalog. And the expectation is that the CTA will be able to measure these, the blue being the observing window for the CTA. And the reason that there's kind of two different shades, these instruments have better sensitivity near the horizon, less so when you're looking up. So you have better sensitivity along here, and less so when you're looking up into here. So that's interesting stuff. If you're looking at kind of the galaxy, I assume this is our Milky Way galaxy, and you're looking at the reach of the CTA, it's a huge increase in reach and in sensitivity to moving out from things like Hess and Veritas and MAGIC. So included there's the approximate locations on these dots of air Cherenkov telescope detectable VHE sources, but the CTA is going to really expand, and you'll be able to increase the reach the entire galaxy and maybe beyond, which will be, I think, very impressive. And one of the things, if you're looking at the plots in terms of the sensitivity of these things, what's being shown here is, let's say that there's a proton accelerator and you're following the e to the minus 1.9 up to a PEV. And, if you're having, if you're talking about what's visible and what's in, what the flux is that would come from something like that, you can see that's along here. But the sensitivity of the CTA, even at 50 hours in the north and the south site, is well beyond that, orders of magnitude better than that. But I will caution that this is enormous new reach, but this is 50 hours on a source. So 50 hours, we said earlier that Hawk, I believe, collects 1400 hours per year. So 50 hours is like, what, 2-3% of your annual, maybe I did that right, somebody will correct me, significant fraction of your annual observing that's going on to detect, to get down into this sensitivity, but it's certainly possible. And then if you can start to think about, actually aiming your telescope at doing these kind of things. So for just as an example, here's something from Hess about one of these sources that would be roughly in line here, showing also still the sensitivity of the CTA. So this is one of the kind of favorite TEV emitting sources. It's incredible the gain in reach that is expected with the new telescope. And so this also traces back to something that we were talking about earlier about the acceleration mechanisms. I had said, you have these two models, you're trying to separate them out. They really separate out primarily at the high energy, which means that most of the current telescopes, you're really running out of sensitivity there. The events are so rare that the statistics are just really poor. And it was really difficult to kind of distinguish between acceleration mechanisms. That's not necessarily the case once you get into something really big that's collecting, like the CTA. So the red squares, it's my understanding, actually include the expected uncertainty on the data. So this would provide more than enough statistics to be able to tell the difference between the shapes. And therefore, you can kind of look at the acceleration mechanism from a source. So this is information that's just incredible that you're going to be able to get. And we can go on. The pointing ability also starts to be pretty impressive. I mean, you're getting to nearly a hundredth of a degree at the highest energies, which that's amazing that you're able to get down to this kind of thing. And this is really important when you're trying to do this kind of astronomy, because you're going to get confusion with the sources, right, in the sky. And this is what I talked about earlier, saying just kind of, casually that the sky is big. The sky is very big. There's a lot of stuff in it. And if you're looking at trying to distinguish things, then, the CTA, the point spread function, basically the pointing resolution, is much smaller than it is for any of the other ones. So if you're looking at trying to be able to distinguish some of these things, trying to be able to distinguish what's going on, for example, in these extended sources, this is where it's going to really pay off to have something big like that. I'm conscious that I'm starting to get a little bit out of time. I think maybe I can continue maybe a few more slides, and then we can maybe have a few questions. So I just wanted to get to this because this is very kind of neat. This is reaching out to our nearby neighbors that are beyond the Milky Way. So what's shown are the the TeV scale observations from the Large Magellanic Cloud. So the left is what we currently see, but CTA makes possible that we're going to be able to do this thing. The other thing to note is the scale for significance has changed between these two plots. In fact, it's gone up by an order of magnitude. So in terms of being able to find things and the predicted ability to do that outside, you know, into neighbors beyond the Milky Way, this is something that CTA is going to make possible, which is fairly impressive. So this is, again, just the sensitivity of the flux sensitivity versus the time spent on source. So you can see here, if you can manage to spend an hour on source, the CTA is already doing much better than the kind of the sensitivity at these, you know, these energies here. So you're improving like 4 to 5 orders of magnitude. So this is really important if something starts to flare, for example, in gamma rays, something, I don't know, there's an AGN or something with the jet is pointed at the local region and we're able to see something. If something goes nova, something like that, you'd be able to see this and be able to distinguish things much more quickly with the CTA, although it still needs to know where to point to see it. There's still the restriction that the sky coverage is not large, but this really brings kind of ties in a whole lot of things together because this is what the multi-messenger field is really good at. You know, you are looking at signals from a number of different messengers. You're looking at being able to combine those signals. Somebody can see something that's happening, tell the CTA that something's happening, and they can go and they can actually look in that area. And so this makes feasible a kind of short turnaround change in focus and then looking at different things. So I think I should probably stop here with this kind of very nice picture, which is the first large telescope at La Palma. This is the northern site for CTA. So construction is underway and apparently proceeding well. So I think I'll stop there because I wanted to leave a little time for questions I will have difficulty answering. So thank you all for listening this far.
Thanks, guys. Questions?
Or maybe people are just disappointed I didn't give you extra time off.
What's that?
Maybe people are just disappointed I didn't give you extra time off like yesterday.
You know, when you're in your picture, you just had a couple slides ago of the Large Magellanic Cloud. There's two things that they can see now. What are those two things?
Sorry, where did it go? Here, what are these two things that are actually able to be seen now? That's a good question. I mean, they're definitely sources of high energy gamma rays, but I don't know what actually those two sources specifically are.
Something that we would know if we're not experts, like supernova 87A or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what those actually are. I'm not sure if Darren knows if he can type in, but
one. I think the bright one. Can you hear me? The bright one is what they call the tarantula nebula. That's my memory. And the other that you see there is I forget. I'd have to look that one up.
Thank you, Darren.
If you just kind of assertively said that's N5A37, I would believe you.
Okay.
Okay. You know, so at this end, we're having the group photo. So everybody here and everybody not here should assemble down in the atrium before you go for coffee. I think it's supposed to happen right at 4. And so this is probably a good time to thank you again, Ken, for stepping in on such short notice.
Thank you all. Have a good photo.